We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, it's Focus. I'm Tom Rogers. Good morning. Jason Croft is our technical director. Focus is our daily talk program. And as we do once every month, you get your chance to ask questions about personal finance with the expert who comes in once a month to talk about finance. He is David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance at the College of Business, the director in the Office of Risk Management and Insurance Research at the University of Illinois. David, I said, joins us once every month, and that means you can have your personal finance questions answered during our 10 o'clock hour. Today on the program, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or on our toll-free line at 800-222-9455, or you can shoot us an email. Our address is will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning, Tom. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Let me begin my remarks this morning with a brief story from a very lovely couple who were very interested in making a mortgage loan to their daughter so she could complete the purchase of a very favorably priced townhouse located in the Chicagoland area. The daughter was a college graduate with a solid job, and I sat down with all three of them to discuss this potential transaction. The parents were interested in extending a loan to their daughter at below interest rates. In other words, if we look at current national rates, we're talking somewhere in the area of 4.5% to 5% for 30-year amortizing loans, and they were interested in making that loan for significantly less. They further observed that the interest they would earn on the mortgage would be better than the interest on a savings account or a CD. Further, the closing costs would be far less for the daughter. And finally, well, the parents wanted to help their daughter with this first transaction. Now, this story is not unusual. It's not atypical, especially in an environment characterized by very tight lending standards from financial institutions. Often people even have a down payment, but they simply can't qualify for the loan based either on their income situation or their credit scores. Now, I insisted that the daughter sign a legitimate promissory note and indeed even a mortgage document, which would be prepared by a real estate attorney. I further insisted that the mortgage be recorded and a title insurance policy be procured. In other words, really pretty much the same requirements you would expect from a traditional, bank lender. The question arose, however, what rate of interest should be charged, as the parents wanted to charge a rather low rate of approximately 2.5% as compared to the conventional mortgage rates of, call it 4.5%, 4.6%, 4.7% on 30-year loans. The appropriate rate to charge is actually an IRS-approved rate called the applicable federal rate. Let me repeat that. There's a rate. It's called the applicable federal rate. In fact, if one Googles the words applicable federal rate, a number of sites will appear with the up-to-date information. Currently, the applicable federal rate for long-term conventional mortgages is 3.6%. And that rate is the minimum rate that should be assessed and detailed in the paperwork to make a bona fide loan as opposed to a gift. And this rate is published monthly, so please be certain to verify the rate before extending a mortgage to a family member or a related party. Kind of interesting information. We get asked that often. What kind of rate should we be charging our kids, our family members, if we're going to loan the money? So stick with that applicable federal rate. Okay, let's change directions for just a moment, and let's talk taxes. Most of us are aware that the Bush tax cuts are scheduled to sunset at the end of the year, absent any new legislation from Congress. Of course, it's anybody's guess whether Congress and the administration can get together this year and reach some meaningful compromise. In the event there is no legislative compromise, here are some of the changes effective January 1, 2011. There's a current 10% tax bracket, which is going to disappear for everyone, and it's going to be replaced with a 15% tax bracket. So people who really didn't make much money and they still were subject to income tax, they were taxed at a 10% marginal rate. That's going to disappear, and it's going to go to 15%. The current highest tax bracket is going to jump from 35% to 39.6%. And the maximum long-term capital gains rate jumps from 15 to 20%. Dividends will generally be taxed at a taxpayer's highest marginal rate instead of the current 15%. So if we're lucky enough to own stock, for example, in some type of after-tax account, and that stock pays a dividend, currently it's a tax preference item, probably taxed at 15%, that is likely to jump to somewhere in a higher marginal rate, maybe 25, maybe 36, maybe even 39.6%. Here's an interesting fact about college savings plans. We'll can revisit those. Those are called 529 plans. They can no longer be used tax-free to purchase computers for schools, which seems to me to be a basic necessity for college students. That's starting January 1. Can you imagine that? I've been saving for my kids for college. I've got a 529 plan. Now I've got to pay for tuition, fees, books, housing, you name it. You know they're going to need a portable computer. And now I'm being told by IRS, nope, that's off limits. You can't use that money for a computer. And if you do, that money may be subject to federal income tax. We all know that estate tax rates are scheduled to go up. Currently, I guess if you die this year, at least so far, you escape federal estate taxation. So I'm wondering what the Steinbrenner family is thinking at this very moment. Are they going to actually, you know, applaud Congress, create, I don't know, maybe hidden impediments so that Congress doesn't do anything this year on estate taxes? But in 2011, the maximum exemption drops just back to $1 million. That's going to impact a whole lot of folks if that rule doesn't change. Now, in 2009, the exempt amount was $3.5 million for someone who passed away. So stay tuned on that one because that's a big, big change. And indeed, estate tax rates are even scheduled to return to old numbers of 50, 55% on the dollar beyond exempt amounts. That seems to be pretty confiscatory. In addition, there's this old thing called the alternative minimum tax. And it was supposed to snare very, very wealthy taxpayers who made huge charitable contributions and did other kinds of things to avoid paying additional tax. So you had to figure your tax two different ways, including a complicated mathematical formula utilizing something called the alternative minimum tax. It's estimated that if Congress doesn't put their annual fix into the alternative minimum tax calculation, why, my goodness, something like 40 to 50 million taxpayers are going to end up paying an alternative minimum tax, adding as much as $2,000 to the typical middle-class tax bill. Oh, my, I guess Congress has got a lot of work in front of them, and all of these potential changes and many others have serious ramifications indeed. And I guess all of us will continue to watch as the Republicans and the Democrats slug it out. I guess that's what it is. It's a slugging match over tax legislation. Finally, each month we revisit our stock market couch potato portfolio, which consists of 8 stock indexes. The portfolio, of course, can be accessed on the WILL website. I know that it was updated just this morning. So through last night's close, year to date, our portfolio is ahead about 4.91%. And, of course, we always compare our results to our benchmark, that being the S&P 500, which is ahead about 2.25% for the year. So at least thus far, Tom, in 2010, diversification seems to be paying off, especially in certain of our holdings. For example, we could take a look at our Vanguard REIT Index. While it only makes up 7% of our entire portfolio, that index year-to-date has surged almost 21%. So it's been a great diversifier year-to-date. Well, there you have it. I'd be delighted to further explore issues I've raised or try to answer the questions posed by our listeners.
Although I'm sure that if you run into some of these taxation problems or 529 problems or anything like that, you can always go back to the First National Bank of Mom and Dad, as you mentioned
there we
during
go.
The beginning. I guess I wasn't
like
aware
that
so
approach.
Many people do that.
I like that approach, the First National Bank of Mom and Dad. I think that's very apropos.
I didn't realize that, one, a lot of people did that. I mean, it's a win-win.
It is
a win-win.
You
mentioned you get a better rate of return if you loan money to the kids. The applicable federal rate.
Yes. That's a tongue twister.
Yes. Is that just for mortgages or is that for any loan that you could make?
No, there are three different rates, actually. There's a short-term, mid-term, and long-term rate. And I was referring to the long-term rate, which essentially is any loan that you're making in excess of 9 years intra-family. Now, as it turns out, is it really a 9-year loan? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe the kids refinance it a year down the road when they have jobs, et cetera, when their income enables them to get a conventional loan, et cetera. But in the short run, if I have savings, for example, and it's earning a whopping 0.2% down at my favorite bank / credit union, et cetera, and I have the opportunity to help my kids and I can earn 3%, 4%, 5%, and it is. It can be a win-win, but one must be careful. We have to have a bona fide promissory note. We have to record a mortgage. It's very important that we do those two things so that we have a bona fide transaction. It's simply not a outright gift transaction.
Right. And you got to make sure your kids are good for the money, too, I guess.
Well, there's an interesting theory. Okay, kids actually paying you back.
Can't make the return without the actual return.
Interestingly enough, often what happens in these cases is the principal gets paid back, and then the interest is actually forgiven.
All right. With that, we'll head to a call. Our numbers, again, are 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside, you can call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. will-talk@illinois.edu. Let us head to the first call on line four this morning in Sullivan. Good morning.
Yes. What is the Illinois state inheritance tax since they decoupled with the federal government?
Well, generally in Illinois, there is a $2 million exemption. So after $2 million, then you start getting taxed and it moves along in a marginal factor. And I don't have those numbers right in front of me. I think we could probably Google them under Illinois inheritance tax on the computer. But typically, if your estate is in excess of $2 million, and this impacts a lot of farm families, a lot of other families, you've got to do some very careful planning because a lot of people just think about the federal estate tax, but there is an Illinois inheritance tax as well. In fact, most states have inheritance taxes. And federal estate tax is a tax that is assessed on the estate itself. It's usually paid out of the estate. Inheritance taxes are often paid by the recipients of the assets. So there is a significant difference, and really it takes an estate attorney who is knowledgeable in these areas. So anyone who has a substantial estate, I would urge, even in this period of limbo, to make certain that they visit with and counsel with an estate attorney.
I know Indiana tax, you are taxed after you receive the rewards of the estate, but in Illinois, the tax is like a federal tax, but I didn't know what the value was, the percent was.
After the $2 million.
Yeah, but do you have any idea what it would be, 5% or 10% or what?
You know, I'd have to look it up. I hesitate to say over the air. I will look it up for you, and I will report back.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be out of the truck, so thank you anyway, sir.
Bye. Thanks for your call this morning. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. I've got an email. A person whose wife and him wants to determine if a financial advisor would be beneficial to them. They say they're 15 years from retirement. They have about $350,000 in savings, nearly all in pre-tax funds through their jobs. And the advisor's fee would be up 1% of investable income. So The investable income, $350,000, $3,500. They have mutual fund money to pay the fee. They'd like to reduce the amount they save through their jobs to augment the mutual funds to pay the fee long term. And they talk in the email about some of the blend of funds that they have.
Okay, well, let's talk about that, especially for a family. This is not unusual, where the lion's share of their funds are really in retirement funds through their place of work. And they may be 401k funds, they may be 403b funds, they may even be 457 funds, but they are likely to be in what's called the defined contribution universe, where you are putting money in to a program, probably you're getting a tax break for it going in, and there may well be some kind of match, for example, by your employer, depending upon the kind of program. The essential question is, we have $350,000 apparently saved. Should we be paying an advisor to professionally manage this at a 1% fee, which I think is a little bit steep under the circumstances? I would prefer that this particular couple counsel initially with a fee financial planner. Now, a fee financial planner is someone who will plan with you on an hourly basis, as opposed to charging a fee on a percentage of assets. And that typical hourly fee for a certified financial planner, someone who may even have other designations, is typically in the area of $175 to $300 an hour. And I think I would prefer that this particular couple counsel for maybe 1 to 2 hours, talk about an asset allocation model. If they're 15 years from retirement, it would not be unreasonable to have 50 to 60% of the assets in equities or equity mutual funds, 40%, for example, in fixed income, sort of what we would call a balanced portfolio, continuing to add to that. And I think probably what a fee financial planner could do for you is look at the menu of choices that these folks have and then reallocate the portfolio. They're probably doing some things very, very well, but maybe they can tweak that portfolio to get a little bit more return out of it and actually reduce the risk, look at diversification, et cetera. So that would be the first step. Rather than committing oneself to, well, 1% of $350,000 is $3,500 a year. That's a lot of professional advice on an hourly basis. So I would start with a certified financial planner who could look at that particular portfolio and maybe suggest some changes within that menu of choices.
So there's a good alternative. Professor David Sinnoh is our guest this morning on Focus. We're taking personal finance questions, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or willtalk@illinois.edu. We take a call now on line one in Champaign. Good morning.
Hello. A couple of months ago, I called in with a question for someone who was standing in for Mr. Sinnoh. Mr. Waspy, I think, was the name.
Yeah, Professor Waspy,
right.
Sure.
Right, okay. And we didn't go into it, but he said it had to do with CDs, and he said something that made me think that he might be suspicious of brokered CDs purchased through a stockbroker. Did I interpret him correctly, and what comments do you have on that?
Well, brokered CDs are typically certificates of deposit that you shop through some national stockbroker. If you go on some of the major websites like Fidelity, like Schwab, like Merrill, and you click on CDs, you can go to a section where there are certificates of deposit for sale that you can purchase from FDIC-insured banks all over the country. And naturally, what people do is they look at the maturity that they are interested in and then choose the highest yielding or highest paying certificate of deposit within that universe. And I was not privy to the comments that Professor Waspy made. My only reservation is that very, very often, local certificate of deposit rates, especially in areas like Champaign County, for example, and surrounding areas, often pay higher rates than the brokered CD rates. Now, the brokers aren't doing this for free. When there is an interest rate that is quoted like 15, 16, 17 basis points or 2% or 3%, whatever it is, the broker is making some money. My only caution, as long as they are FDIC insured, understand that these institutions are buying deposits. They're trying to buy deposits. They need deposits, so they are paying a little bit higher rate of return. And if something happens to one of those institutions, then, and it is taken over by the FDIC, about the worst that can happen to you is that the interest that had accrued would be paid, but you could get a notice that the interest rate has changed. All right? But as long as you do business with an FDIC-insured institution, then you're still in good shape, and you could certainly buy a brokered CD.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I hope that answers your question. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 for David Sinnoh. And we continue in Champaign, a call on line two. Good morning.
Good morning. You mentioned that the REITs have gone up significantly, the Vanguard REITs fund. So the question I have is, would you then say this is a time not to buy them, or is it a time to buy them? Do they have room to go further?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because I have discussed this with my friends all over the country, is what in the world is driving these REITs, especially where we have substantial vacancies in shopping centers across the country, warehouses across the country, et cetera. A lot of the recovery in REITs were really beaten up over the last 18 months. So a lot of this represents just simple recovery. One of the reasons that REITs took such a terrible beating over the last 18 to 24 months prior to this recent period was the fact that many of them were financially in trouble. In other words, there was not enough income to service the outstanding mortgage loans. So what has happened is that a lot of properties have been consolidated. Banks have made compromises, especially money center banks, and have refinanced a number of these. Additional capital has come in to restabilize a lot of these projects, and specifically the companies that own these projects. So I think what we're seeing is a recovery, or just sort of a normal technical snapback, along with additional capital coming to the table. As far as investing a great deal of money at this point in time in REITs, I would be very suspect. However, as part of an overall asset allocation strategy and dollar cost averaging strategy, that's okay. But to suddenly go out and place a great deal of money in REITs, I can't recommend that. That would not be a strategy that I would suggest.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up then?
Certainly can.
If one has, let's say, a certain amount of cash, where would you suggest putting a significant amount of money? In what specific, I mean, you mentioned the Vanguard REIT funds. So if not that, where would you put money in now rather than just the U.S. Treasury or some other bond fund or some other money market?
Are you looking to invest in equities?
Well, that's the question. I mean, is it's the choice, as I see it, is equities, bonds or REITs, or just plain leave it in cash funds?
Well, it depends on your overall asset allocation strategy. It depends upon your age, et cetera. I'm a great believer long-term in the U.S. and world stock markets. All right? And that's my point. So I think that at least a percentage of everyone's assets, to the extent they have assets, should be in some diversified stock strategy. Having said that, it is so very important to dollar cost average into these positions. And if I was just starting to dollar cost average into a stock portfolio, I would be doing that over 24 to 30 months. So if I was going to take a sum of money, I would take 1/24th or 1/30th of it each month and average into these positions.
What about the European stock? There's a Vanguard European stock index or something.
There
like
is.
That.
And the stock indexes that I like abroad are the International Value Index, Total International Stock Market Index, and the Emerging Markets Index. So if you don't have exposure to Europe, which is, of course, has its own problems, and you don't have exposure to the emerging markets, those are all good choices.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call. Hope we got some questions answered. And I assume you're not going to be taking the REITs off the couch potato portfolio.
No, I'm not. No, not at all. They continue to have a 7% position. In other words, 7 cents of every dollar that's invested in the couch potato portfolio are in REITs.
All right. Let's take another call in Champaign on line 3. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello, good morning.
We're waiting for your question.
Okay. I have a brief remark to make. Haven't heard, maybe I start listening a little bit too late, but haven't heard anything the gentleman to say about annuities. And I truly believe that the history shows that only people through any depression, recession, etc., who have their money into annuities never lost a dime. Not only, but they have a guarantee money for life, guarantee income, and they are the best vehicles. All those hedge funds and mutual funds and everything else, if you're not inside player, you're losing money, playing with the fire, with the stocks and market, and somebody is manipulating those. Insurance products like annuity, fixed annuity, equity index annuity, are the best for people ever. You never can outlive your money. And my question, quick question is, a friend of mine recently told me that there is a new law which come into effect 2013 that when we sell our houses, if we sell our houses, there's going to be 3.5 or 3.8% of new tax, sell taxes, is that correct? Do you know anything about this? New, some kind of a Obama law or some administration law, is that correct?
Okay, you've raised a number of questions. Let's first talk about the annuities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what people have historically done mm-hmm. is that they have basically invested their money in a promise to pay from an insurance company.
That's
in other
correct.
Words, let's say that you took $10,000 of money and you handed it to the insurance company in return for their promise to pay a tax-deferred interest rate on that money, maybe 2%, maybe 5%, maybe 55%, whatever it was. And at some point in the future, you would then access that money, presumably in retirement.
That's correct.
And when that money comes out, the first money that comes out is considered a return on your investment, hence it is taxed. And then eventually, if you utilize all of that money, then we eventually get back to principal, and there is no tax on the principal, right?
That's correct.
They are usually sold on the basis that these are tax-deferred investments, so that the interest is not taxed along the way. It's only when you take it out.
That's correct.
Different kind of annuity is called a variable annuity. That's usually referred to as a single premium or multi-premium fixed annuity. There's also something called a variable annuity,
yeah.
where once again we hand money to an insurance company, but this time the insurance company offers us a menu of stock or mutual fund choices.
Yes.
And then
you have less guarantees there.
You have no guarantees. It is basically a result of your own investment acumen as to how you come out. But I think what you were referring to as is really the single premium deferred annuity where you have a fixed rate of return.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Or equity index where you have guarantees and you do have some equity, but you have guarantees. This is what I like. They are insurance product.
Well, they are an insurance product. And in actuality, what we have discovered, especially with the equity index product,
yes.
that you would have been better off if you had simply invested in the S&P 500 for a number of reasons. One is that if you have a gain, it's treated as a capital gain as opposed to in an annuity, which is an ordinary gain. So
yes.
it's ordinary income tax. And number two, in the equity products, the insurance company keeps the dividends. You don't get the dividends. The insurance company keeps them, which historically is made up of about 40 to 50% of the return in an equity product. So I am very negative. They have very high expense ratios. I don't think that's a good idea. All right? That's my opinion. However, with respect to an annuity, just a simple annuity. There is a place in a portfolio for that. You can't outlive your money. The problem with these annuities are that they suffer from the ravages of inflation. That's the big problem. So that while you may be receiving a fixed amount of money each month, assuming there is inflation, the dollar value, the purchasing power of that money goes down. So, for example, if inflation went to 5% on an annual basis, then your purchasing power in 14 years is in half. That is a problem with an annuity. However, people can buy something called an immediate annuity, and that's the type of annuity. I haven't talked much about it, but there may well be a place for an immediate annuity in a portfolio, and that is when you retire, you hand a lump sum of money to an insurance company, and they pay you an annuitized rate on that money. And indeed, the kinds that I like are the ones that are adjusted for inflation. So you can buy an inflation-adjusted immediate annuity, and there may well be a place for that in an individual's portfolio. So there may well be, as I mentioned, a product in the insurance atmosphere, in the insurance line of products called an inflation-adjusted immediate annuity that could indeed make sense. Now, with respect to this increase in tax, we're talking about wealthy taxpayers. And as part of the new health insurance program that is scheduled to really come into fruition in its totality in 2013 and 2014, there is going to be a surtax. So if you are considered one of these wealthy folks, I believe the numbers are $250,000 for a married couple of the AGI, adjusted gross income, $200,000 if you're single, you're going to have a surtax to help pay for the medical costs of this program on interest, dividends, and certain capital gains. In other words, it's going to so if you have a standard dividend on a stock and it's going to get taxed at whatever marginal rate, well, for wealthy people, that might be 35, 39.6%. There's going to be an additional 3.8% surtax on top of that. So that's what your friend was talking about.
Yes. So do we need to go back to England or?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess that's the topic of another discussion, and far from me to address that.
Politics for another day.
Politics for another day. You had great questions. Thanks for calling in.
All right. Thank you for your call. Again, our numbers are 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Your questions for David Sinnoh, including this one that came in this morning. Person who says he's a federal worker within a few years of retirement. Simple question, why should he care about deflation? We talked about deflation as a possible hazard as we go through this these economic problems. So from his perspective, why should he care about deflation?
Well, let's talk about the concept of deflation, which is the gradual erosion of prices and values. So if we own a home, then the value of that home drops. And interestingly enough, you're in the catbird seat if you're a federal worker. Because if you are a federal worker close to retirement, that means you have a defined benefit plan. You have a pension plan with the federal government. And that's one pension that probably is going to be paid because we can always print more money. And if we print more money, of course, we're probably going to have more inflation as opposed to deflation. But deflation impacts everyone. And, of course, in that scenario, cash, interestingly enough, becomes king because you can buy things at cheaper and cheaper prices. But what happens is we have a slowdown in general economic activity. We have a slowdown in the delivery of services for everyone. And life won't be real pleasant. That's the bottom line. Life is not pleasant in a deflationary economy, regardless of how many dollars you have.
Or where your pension is coming from.
No question about it.
All right.
But as far as having a pension today, with less than 20% of the American workforce being in a position of having a pension, If you're a federal worker, that's a great place to be because that pension is going to be guaranteed.
Okay, so worry, but, well, maybe not so much.
Exactly.
All right, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Let us move to a caller on line one in Urbana. Good morning. Hello, Urbana, line one. And it's not there. So let's move to line two. Champagne, are you on the line? Line two.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
All right.
I had a question on your thoughts on energy partnerships. I have some cash that I wanted to move. I'm recently retired, and so I'm interested in increasing my dividend income. There's some energy partnerships that pay pretty high percent return. My understanding is they have to pay most of their profits out. So you can get a dividend of 4-6% on some of these firms. I was wondering, how is that handled for tax purposes? Is that considered a dividend, or is that considered, I believe some of it is also viewed as return on investment.
Some of it is return of capital, and some of it is dividends.
Yeah, so
all right, it's both.
It is dividend. So how does that work then? Does your basis go down then when they're returning the capital?
When you have a return of capital, basically your basis would let me think about that for just a moment in my head. Dividends, that part is easy.
Sure.
So we know that. And by the way, are these energy partnerships that you're talking about publicly traded energy partnerships?
Sure. One example would be Kinder Morgan.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I've looked at that for years but have never purchased it, but my father's had it for quite a few years.
Okay.
There's some other ones, I think KPP, which is another pipeline system.
Exactly.
Distribute stuff.
Exactly.
Seems like,
and these are really higher dividend-paying stocks. Yeah.
Seem like it would be a good thought these days because I have a lot of money that's just parked on the sidelines.
Well, I think if you were going to invest in these energy partnerships, you'd want to look at least two or three of them.
Sure.
And I would also dollar cost average into them. Mm-hmm. It would reduce your basis with the return of capital. But essentially, they are paying out somewhere between, I'm looking at them, typically 3-7%, I believe, mm-hmm. On average. But you've got to be careful because some of that is a return of capital.
All right, very good. Well, thank you very much. I enjoy your program, and there's always interesting things to think about.
Right. All right, and thanks for your call. David Sinnoh is our professor of in residence, I suppose, on financial matters. You can still give your call, about 15 minutes left in the show, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Line 3 in Urbana, good morning.
Hello. May we go back to the excise tax for just a moment?
Sure.
That is only on the marginal income above $250,000. Am I right?
This is the state tax, correct?
What are we talking about? Are we talking about this 3.8% surtax?
Yes.
That's for the wealthy taxpayers, correct?
Yes.
Right. Correct.
So that is on the marginal income. So if you made $250,000 and $1, you'd pay it on $1.
Correct.
And if you made $300,000, you'd be paying it on $50,000. I bring this up only because there's been a lot of scare tactics, and I'm not accusing you of this. You were quite straightforward with it. But it isn't going to affect most people very much, and even those with high incomes, unless they're very, very high, it isn't particularly burdensome.
No, it impacts people who have adjusted gross incomes in excess of $250,000.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah,
and that's not a whole lot of people, admittedly, but it's still a substantial number of people.
Well,
and the question always arises philosophically, do you want to increase taxes on wealthier people who typically are small business owners, et cetera? That's a whole nother argument,
mm-hmm.
Who drive a lot of the employment and a lot of the business in this country.
And that's a very legitimate question. I bring it up only because the critics generally picture it as everyone.
As draconian, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right.
And that someone who makes $250,000 is going to be taxed on that entire income, which is not correct.
No, it's marginal.
Right.
Of course it's marginal.
I just wanted to bring it up because I thought you gave a very good discussion of it, with the exception of not pointing that out, and I assume you simply assumed everyone realized that.
No, your point is well taken. So thank you for calling in.
And I'd like to compliment you on your program again. It's one of the best.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that very much.
All right, and thanks for calling in. Let's go to line one, another call in Urbana. Good morning. Hello, line one. I thought I heard something there, but I guess not.
Hello?
Oh, there we are. There we are. Hello.
I got cut off before.
Go ahead.
My question is about REITs. Would you explain what REITs is?
Well, the acronym for REIT, R-E-I-T, is Real Estate Investment Trust, but it's really not a trust at all. It typically is a publicly traded corporation which has certain tax advantages. Now, REITs have to be in the business of real estate. They have to be in the business of buying, selling, managing, owning real estate. That is their sole business. They can't make toys. They can't make computers. They're simply in the real estate business. If the corporation is strictly in the real estate business and distributes on an annual basis at least 90% of its profits back to its shareholders, then there is no double taxation. Because you see, if we own a share of stock in IBM, and IBM at the end of the year makes $1 billion, then IBM has to pay federal income tax on that money, pay state income tax as well on that money where they do business, and then we as shareholders get something left over in the term of dividends. We'll get a distribution after they've already paid money to the government in terms of tax. So most major corporations, we have what is called double taxation. The corporation pays tax at the corporate level. We as shareholders, when we receive dividends, pay tax at our individual level. With a REIT escapes paying federal tax, so long as they distribute most of their profits in the form of dividends back to the shareholders, and then we as shareholders report that on our personal income tax return. So typically, REITs will pay a higher dividend than most regular type corporations, presuming, of course, that the REITs are well managed, they have made solid investments, and they can then return substantial income in the form of dividends to the shareholders. That's what a REIT is. Now, I don't buy individual REITs. I'm frankly not smart enough to buy individual stocks. So I like to buy a whole slew of them at once. I like to buy, in other words, an index. And in our couch potato portfolio, for example, is the Vanguard REIT Index, which consists of the very, very large REITs. I think there are about 90 of them in that index, and they're on a market-weighted basis, just like the S&P 500. So I hope that explains what a REIT is and how it operates.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Glad to be of assistance. And let's take a call right now. Oops. Oh, I just cut off the caller I was going to get. I'm sorry. If you call from St. Charles, give us a call right back. Let's take a call from Champaign right now on line two. Good morning.
Hi. I'm calling back. I was the one who I called earlier about the REITs, but you do, when you were talking about the marginal rates, you made the point that it's mostly for the wealthy. But I think there's an important point that many, many small businesses are going to be subject to that because they treat them their taxes as individual taxes, their business income as individual income, and therefore file as individuals. And therefore, this $250,000 limit is really going to end up hitting many small businesses that employ people, let's say five or more people, and therefore will result in those businesses, one, not hiring people, two, laying off people, three, not making capital investments, and therefore not driving the employment and growth that we need. And I think that's something that's left out when we think, oh, it means people who are making more than $250,000 because of the tax code. And I'm sure you know plenty about that.
Well, you're preaching.
Let you talk.
Good. You're preaching to the choir here, because the truth of the matter is that most folks who earn more than $250,000 a year own their own small businesses. So you are preaching to the choir. And many of these folks who own their own small businesses set them up as sub-S corporations, which means that all of the income and all of the revenues and all of the profits basically devolve directly back to the individuals on an individualized basis. So all of that money is then taxed at their marginal rate. And the minute you are above, for example, it's estimated next year, $215,000, your marginal federal bracket is already 36%. So you're going to be taxed on that next marginal dollar at 36%. And there does become a question of whether or not raising taxes, raising tax brackets, is going to have a dilatory negative impact on a small business person hiring more people. Essentially, when it looks like the medical expenses to provide medical coverage for those employees is also going to go up. We're just caught between a rock and a hard place here. There are no easy solutions.
All right. We finally have our caller in St. Charles. Thanks for sticking around with us, and I apologize for cutting you off there, but good morning.
That's okay. No problem. I'd have the same problem with those buttons, too, if I was there. You know what? I'm a small business owner, okay, and I, you know, my same concern that the guy that called in before me. Now, the guy that called in before him, I disagree with full-heartedly because he doesn't know how much the Subways are making. He doesn't know how much the Dairy Queens and the pizza joints are making. And when you've got four, five, six employees, sure, you're maybe making $250,000 or $300,000 a year, but you're lucky when you're through if you get $80,000 a year because you're paying all the taxes, you're paying for all the stuff, the employees. You know, basically, I'm not working anymore. I'm out of business. I'm not going to deal with this issue anymore. And that's what's going to happen. I'm just one of many, many people I know that have lost their businesses because of this. They're all going to go work for, you know, maybe a Barnes and Noble or somebody else like that. You know, because we're all in the same boat. We're tired of paying taxes and for services not rendered. And my question is, would this situation come up? There's going to be a lot of interesting things tied into the real estate market. That's a whole nother issue. I'm actually looking. I've got 3 more years left on my mortgage, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to make that because of the lack of work and the lack of, you know, just compensation. It seems like they want to use the taxpayer to get as much blood out of you as you can, even though you're not making it. You know, and I'm just wondering what your comments are, and I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I know it must be enormously frustrating for a small business if you were in a small business and you have gross revenues of $200,000 or $300,000, and then by the time that you get done with all the frustration, working 80 hours a week that a lot of small business people do, to see that it's actually you end up with a number that you could end up with if you were employed somewhere else. So that is certainly a problem, and I can sympathize with that caller. I think what I was pointing out is that there are just large numbers of small businesses that actually drop to the bottom line income after everything of $250,000 or more. So we're not really talking about gross revenues of $250,000. We're talking about taxable income,
like sort of net
of $250,000. Okay. Sort of we could call that net income.
Okay.
And whether or not having some of that tax now at 39.6% plus a 3.8% surcharge, is that too burdensome? Does that dissuade employers from expanding and hiring and trying to increase the size of their business? And indeed, for many, the answer is probably yes.
All right. We can get one more call in with the remaining time on our show. That call is in Champaign on line 3. Good morning.
Yes, I know that the Republican Party typically takes note that some 50% of all small businesses will be affected by this. But I want to take note of something that Paul Krugman and others have taken note of. The actual percentage is estimated to be between 5 and 25 percentile of all small businesses on the whole. And another thing that Krugman took note of, and he did this twice on his blog and in the New York Times as well in his main column, that out of that $700 billion that this will cost, if it's not ended, that more than $350 billion will go to 120,000 people, the top 0.04% of the United States electorate. That means that each one of them will receive individually more than $3 million. Could you respond to that?
Well, first of all, the increase in the tax rate, if we use Krugman's numbers, moving from 5 to 25% of small businesses, that's still an enormous number of small businesses. Remember that 6 out of every 10 new jobs, permanent jobs in this country, are created by small businesses. Approximately 4 out of every 10 are created by large businesses, typically with employees of over 1,000 employees. So this is going to be burdensome for small businesses. Now, in terms of the lion's share of the tax benefits going to the top 1% or 1/10 of a percent, yes, that is what has happened. The argument is, and I'm not sure what the answer is, I'm not disagreeing with you necessarily. The argument is that historically, what has moved a country out of recession is when wealthier people spend. All right? Wealthier people drive the economy. It's not the typical 50%, it's the upper 5 to 1% that drive the economy. And whether or not this will further exacerbate the situation, only time will tell. So I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. At least, do these 120,000 people need to have an additional $3 million tax cut apiece? I'm not saying that's the case. What I am saying is that wealth has typically driven the economy. They've been the leading force, the leading drivers of the economy.
Are you suggesting that they will stimulate the economy in a way that your average person who has to spend that money would if they were given that $350 billion?
I'm simply saying that they are more likely to have a major impact on the economy than perhaps myself. That's all I'm saying.
I don't think there's evidence of that in terms of the stimulus, and most economists would not agree with you.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it at that because the show is about to end. And, David, if you had any comments to wrap up,
no,
we'll leave it at
that.
No,
I think what we find is that we have just tremendously intelligent listeners to WILL. They are clearly in a class by themselves.
And they like discussion, too.
And they like discussion, and I appreciate discussion, and it's wonderful to have a free media where reasonable people can intelligently disagree.
All right. We will be back. You will be back next month with David Inch to further the discussion on personal finance. Dr. David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance at the College of Business at the U of I and director of the Office of Risk Management and Insurance Research. Stay tuned.